Society is the largest grassroots network of FSHD patients, their families, and research activists. The FSHD Society offers a community of support, news, and information for the millions of people affected by FSHD worldwide. This is FSHD Society Radio. Hey, welcome, welcome all to the FSHD Society Radio Show. Thanks for being here yet again on another episode as we bring in the night before Halloween. So I hope you're not all creeped out quite yet, end of the month here. Last Wednesday of every month, we try to give you this show live here on Facebook. You can also listen to the playbacks, find our podcast anywhere you find podcasts. That's like Spotify and Stitcher and Apple Podcasts and you name it. We're pretty much out there. Wanted to welcome all of you today because we had a great guest that's going to be in store today. We'll introduce him in a couple minutes. It's Alan Brown from the NFL Films, so he'll be on here in a couple seconds. Just wanted to kind of get the ball rolling, let you all be aware of a couple things before we bring him on. First off, I wanted to include everybody on this interesting FSHD Society Radio idea that's going to be a telethon. It's going to be a marathon for me a little bit, and I hope it's going to be fun for you guys to join in on us. It's going to happen on December 3rd, which is Giving Tuesday. If you go hashtag Giving Tuesday, you can see all the information on there. If you Google that, what we're going to do for that day is more or less, I call it a telethon, and we're going to go Facebook Live in four different chunks throughout the day, starting at 7 a.m. to 10 a.m. and then like 11 a.m. to 2, 4 p.m. To 7 p.m. and then 8 p.m. to 11. And yeah, it's going to be kind of a marathon. And I'm excited for it. It's my idea. Careful what I wish for, right? We have a lot of guests that are lining up right now to be a part of it. So this is how it's going to go on that day. In the morning, we're going to have 20-minute segments, and we're going to have guests filling in those 20 minutes. Featured guests like the person we're having on today will also be during the telethon. Chris Carino, a former guest. He's announcer of the Brooklyn Nets. Dave Lucas from the Chicago chapter. We'll have Scott Harper, a scientist. We'll have Jen Egerton, Amy Becker on, Ryan Levingston, Taylor Quigg, George Pollack, Curtis and Allison Calder. We'll have Carden Wakoff on. We will have Lexi Pappas on, even Max Adler, and so on. And we're still filling in some slots, but as you can see from morning to night on December 3rd, it's going to be this huge telethon. I call it huge because I will basically be sitting here for you on Facebook Live from 7 a.m. till 11 p.m. with only about three breaks in there. And I'm willing to do it. I love to do it. I can't wait to do it. I'm going to see if I can test myself a little bit here as we jump from guest to guest on that day. And I think it's going to be a lot of fun. So if you go on to, you know, Giving Tuesday, Google that up, you'll see what it's all about. You know, it's all about how the giving season starts. It's the Tuesday after Thanksgiving. You know, it's the holiday season. People have a tendency to be in a very charitable mood that day. So we decided, let's try a telethon on that day. So that's going to be a lot of fun, that I hope. Yeah, so I was actually willing to do that without even having a break, but then June said, well, you're probably going to have to use the bathroom, maybe get a bite to eat, I suppose. No one wants to see anybody eat or hear anybody eat, so I get it. I get it. So I do look forward to that. So I don't want to wait really much longer here because we have Alan Brown is waiting on air. I want to invite him in right away. We're not going to go to break today. We're gonna bring him in right away because I'm excited to bring in Mr. Brown here because he works for NFL Films. I like the NFL. I think a lot of you do. Maybe you can chat in what kind of your favorite NFL teams you have and whatnot. But so without further ado, I'd like to introduce you all to Mr. Alan Brown. Hello, Mr. Brown. How are you?
Good evening. How are you, Tim?
I am doing great. I am so glad you're here. You are a very patient man because we had tech issues last time we attempted this, and you were so gracious that day and quickly said, yeah, I can come back in October, and here we are. It seems like a blink, and we're already here in the end of October, and just really excited that you had the opportunity to kind of sit down and talk with us yet again.
Great. Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate your patience.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, I mean, I really want to talk a little bit right off the bat because, you know, some of what was posted on the FSHD Society's webpage about the show is that you work for NFL Films. But before we get too far down that line, because I'm kind of NFL geeked about those questions, tell us a little bit about yourself. Who's Alan Brown? Where are you from? And maybe roll that into a little bit of your FSHD story.
Sure. I mean, I'm 53 years old. I'm from the Philadelphia area. Was diagnosed when probably I was 23, 24. And, you know, have kind of been, you know, adjusting as the disease morphs. So it's kind of, as it progresses, you obviously have to make changes with how you live and adapt. And sometimes those adaptions or changes happen slowly. Sometimes they happen really fast, and you have to make sudden adjustments. So I know that people that have the disease are aware of that. And we all have that in common. That we all have to adapt as things change in us. And so as my physical condition has changed over the years, my career has too. So it starts off doing one thing, and I'm fortunate enough to work for a company that's been able to adapt as I've had to work. And they've been really great about that.
So when
I have a family, a wife, and a daughter who are both incredibly supportive and on a lot of different levels. So, you know, they've seen everything change and they've adapted as well. So as things alter, they have had to alter what they do. And so that's been really kind of, I'm grateful for that too, most of all.
Yeah, I think a lot of people listening would agree to probably shaking their heads in acknowledgement of that, you know, your families kind of go with it right with you, alongside you. I've said it in the past that sometimes I almost look at my wife and say, you know, sometimes it's like, it feels like you almost as well have had it with me. You know, you're right in the trenches. So the support is huge.
Totally.
Yeah, so huge to have the family behind you. Now, who else in your family has or had FSHD?
My mother has it, and my brother has it. Those are the other two diagnosed people.
Okay.
That are in my immediate sphere. But it goes back to my grandmother, we think, and to my great-grandmother.
Wow, okay.
So neither of them were obviously diagnosed for or anything. It's just a theory.
Mm-hmm.
Based on, obviously, what, you know, their physical challenges that they had. So that's always, you know, in a way that's always been in a way a source of strength, but also, you know, a recognition that is something that plagues a family, but knowing that there's others that have survived, or it's a source of strength as well as a sense of some sort of history.
This is the FSHD Society Radio Show. We're talking with Alan Brown. Currently, I believe he's the Director of Business Development at NFL Films. He also has FSHD, and we're talking a little bit about Alan's story and his FSHD story. So, you know, I do know it's not super uncommon, obviously, for other people in your family to have it. So did it come to you as a surprise when you were diagnosed at around that, you know, age of 23, 24?
Yeah, it was a total surprise. I was the first one diagnosed with it. And obviously, the manifestation of the disease is different from person to person. So, but I was the first diagnosis, and it was part of, they thought I had something else until I was able to explain that there were other family members that I think have some of the same symptoms. And you know, they're like, oh, absolutely, that kind of, in the middle of saying that, I said, yeah, well, this is what you have, and that makes sense. So that was interesting. It was out of nowhere, and the diagnosis, and but then after that, things made sense. So. What we were overlooking really obvious things. And I would imagine other people do that too. You're just not thinking. Maybe somebody objectively looking in would see it, but, for some reason we didn't. And I was the first one diagnosed, and it was kind of like, a big realization of, holy crap, this is, your grandmother, your great grandmother,
right,
we all had these similar symptoms.
What were the symptoms that brought you to the doctor that, you know, started on that path to diagnosis?
Foot drop. Primarily was, you know, tripping and falling for, the symptoms of being able to raise your arms and, you know, sleeping, you know, being able to close your eyes at night, you know, certain things were always there. But we didn't think anything of them, as odd as that may seem. But when I started tripping and falling, and then also I did, you know, I did have some, loss of muscle mass when I was 20, which was kind of unexplained. But in hindsight, it's like, man, I don't understand why I didn't go to the doctor. But that's how things kind of shook out. But it was, you know, a foot drop, a bilateral foot drop is exactly what took me to the doctor.
We have a guest on Facebook Live right now asking a question. I think it's a little relevant. It is relevant to what we're talking about now with the diagnosis process. This is Belinda Miller asking, when was Alan diagnosed? 70s, 80s, 90s? I don't want to put you in a bad spot, Alan. That's going to kind of then maybe make people do some math and figure out how old you are. So as long as you're comfortable with that.
That's cool. I don't care. I'm 53 now. So
okay.
I'm a horrible mathematician. And so whatever I was in 1993 is...
Okay.
Or 92 or 93.
92, 93 then. Okay. There you go, Belinda. We got your question on there. If you guys, all listeners, have questions, please feel free to do what Belinda did and send those across. That would be great. She said that she was in the 70s is when she was diagnosed. So, you know, a little bit of connection there, right? That's always how we all, I think it's interesting, FSHers, as we all call ourselves in a way, that we do have that little bit connection of, you know, diagnosis stories and the timing and this. Were you athletic then, you know, before your diagnosis or during that time, you know, before the foot drop occurred, or did it not affect that part of your life?
No, I was never somebody that was always, you know, that liked to go to the gym, but I did like to do a lot of hiking. I used to ski. But mostly, yeah, I think that I led a pretty active lifestyle. What I did for a living was, I needed to be able to lift or carry or do things. Mm-hmm. So that was all part of it. But it was, early on in the diagnosis, the doctor at U of T that really diagnosed me formally was like, you're not going to be able to do what you're doing forever. You need to think about going down a career path that will get you off of your feet so that you won't be, working on a shed carrying sandbags or carrying lights or being, you need to take control of your career and put it in a trajectory in which you will not be physically reliant on, or not be reliant on my ability to do things physical, mm-hmm. which is what I was doing at that time. When you're early on in your film career, people are PAs, production assistants. Mm-hmm. You're doing whatever you got to do. You're carrying lights, carrying equipment, and as you're freelancing and you're young, you're doing lots of different things on set to help. So it was that diagnosis that really was a wake-up call to take control of my career to an extent that I'm not doing something physically demanding, and prepare for down the line where I won't be able to.
So
where I would have some sort of, mobility issues.
You brought up being a production assistant, carrying lights. So you obviously, earlier we teased about the NFL Films position, but it sounds like you've been in TV industry for a long time. Can you talk a little bit about that, the earlier days and kind of what drew you that way into that line of work?
Well, I always wanted to be in some sort of, involved somehow in the visual arts or the arts somehow. So I graduated with a degree in film, mm-hmm. and a month after I graduated, I was hired at NFL Films as a production assistant, which was the lowest position in the company, which was, do whatever they tell you to do. And,
sure.
Work long hours and get paid very little, which was the case at the time.
Right.
And I was at Films for a couple of years and I left because I knew at Films at that time was really, it was a different company than it is now. And I knew that I wanted to be there. I mean, in college, I knew that I wanted to be there. And, but at that point, I had to leave because I wanted to learn other skills and learn how the industry worked in the real world. NFL Films at that time was really a unique, isolated bubble that ran its own way. Hmm. It was really an amazing thing to see. It functioned in a way on its own, but didn't necessarily understand how things work out in the rest of the world. How did things run? Mm-hmm. How did you put together a shoot? How did you do a shoot? How did you work on a project? And it was different. And I wanted to learn that process. And so I left Films, went to another company for a little bit. And it was a very painful process because, I left people that I really loved and I left a company that I loved. I had to, and this was before the diagnosis. Mm-hmm. This was in 1990. I had to figure out a way to build up value. But in the process of doing so, you know, I was living on very little money and didn't have a lot of direction, and had to work my way up on the outside in the industry and learn different skills and learn how to learn all the different positions and learn the hierarchy and how to run a set and how do you even find a place to shoot and who shows up to shoot. Like, all these things about the industry that I wasn't learning at films, I was able to learn on the outside and see how things run. How do you prepare? How do you plan? And so I was doing that for about 5 or 6 years while working at restaurants. And at some point, you know, moving to New Mexico to, you know, explore life a little bit. Then moving back, starting from the bottom, you know, so there were, I did not take the quickest path from point A to point B. I did not take the most direct route, but was committed to, I guess, figuring it out and taking risks and chances, mm-hmm. and learned. And then one day in 95, the phone rang. It was NFL Films. Hmm. But, you know, we want to provide support to our productions and increase the production level a little bit. Can you come back for a season and help us put together shoots for our projects? Hmm. And I said, absolutely, would love to come back. So I was freelance full-time for a season, and then was hired back full-time in 96 for my second stint. I've been there since.
Wow. That's great.
So, and yeah, it's been great being there. So you've seen the whole world morph from a world of an analog world to something, and the analog world of film, or the world of film when I first entered, was a very tactile thing. You were touching film, seeing film, you know, splicing film together. It was really hands-on, and really time-intensive and laborious. And see that transition to digital, where you're not touching anything. Or, you know, you're putting film on airplanes and flying it back, as opposed to putting a card into a drive 3,000 miles away and a file shows up in Mount Laurel. So, I mean, I've seen all that, and that's pretty cool.
You've seen the whole evolution of it, from one.
Yeah, I remember, the beginning of nonlinear editing with the Avid and probably the early 90s, you know, seeing that technology evolve and then have it change an entire workflow. It's cool.
Listening to FSHD Society Radio, talking to Alan Brown of NFL Films, and we've talked about his FSHD story. Now we're talking a little bit about his career. And you're back here now at NFL Films. You said you've been there since, 95, you were asked back, and then 96, you were hired, it sounds like, more directly, not as a freelance person. You've been there since. So you've been there a couple different times, and What was the first project, if you can go to the Wayback Machine here and go in the memory banks, and can you tell us a little bit about the first NFL Films project you were a part of, you know, about either the team it was about or the player?
Well, the first shoot day that I did, one of the first shoot days that I did, we had a little studio in our old place, and the first thing we were doing was a commercial with Franco Harris.
Oh, yeah.
For, I think, like Subaru dealers. And so I show up, and there was this freelance director there. And so we would do work for people, and you have this freelance director. A production company would come in, and they would probably use us to, you know, hire us. I was, you know, 22, so I don't know the background of the job. But it was a director that every other word was, "Hey, babe. You can talk to me, babe." And he's talking to Frank, like, "Hey, babe. Frank, babe, you can talk to me." You know. And so it's Franco Harris, and we had to roll the car into the frame. So you have like a yeah, there's Franco standing there, and a car rolls into the frame. And I remember that the camera guy that was operating the camera, Hank, you know, rolled the camera. His also job was to roll the camera into the frame and then get behind the camera and shoot the.
Oh my god!
Yeah, so that's kind of we were old school. We were fun, and I said, "Wow, that's interesting." And you know, my first studio shoot was another one was, you know, a ridiculously long shoot. We would do the show that's still on the air called This is the NFL. Now it's NFL Films Presents.
Mm-hmm.
And it was with Steve and Harry Cal. And we had this new piece of technology, Ultimate, where you would key in backgrounds over, you know, like a chroma key type background. And we were there till 3 a.m. doing that for some ridiculous reason. And I was prompter in the show, teleprompter.
Mm.
So that was our first time working with Steve and you know, the likeness of Harry Callis, who was awesome.
Callis. Yeah.
Both of them.
Wow. Yeah. Great voices. Yeah. Great staples of the NFL films. I was about to ask you, I know that when I first had the impression of NFL films, was when I was young. I don't even know what age I was or even exactly what I was watching of it. But the vocal background, the certain type of music, maybe this might have been in the 80s, I want to guess. And the shot of the football just simply spinning in the air, you know, with the backdrop of the blue sky, and then just gently falling into someone's grasp, you know, on a deep pass route. And I was just absolutely mesmerized by a game that normally I was like, oh, this is really tough and you might get hurt. It's really brutal. To something like that, it made it look beautiful and graceful. And I think that NFL films has had a huge impact in the way, you know, obviously footballs are now looked at probably because of that shot.
Well, I mean, it's what they did is it also had a huge impact on popular culture.
Mm-hmm.
You may not realize it, but that style of storytelling, which was, yeah, at NFL Films was the brainchild of Ed and Steve Sable. It was built on a foundation of, you know, great cinematography, great music, mm-hmm. Great script narration. You know, so you kind of blended these things and, you know, you created this mythology that lives on. And a lot of us, like our memory, where our memories are images of the game. And in many instances, our imprint of its imprint on popular culture still is relevant. But, you know, those floating in the air shots or, you know, the slow motion, you know, really highlight the physicality of the game and make it like a ballet or a drama. So that's the, you know, it's kind of like the secret sauce is, you know, how do we elevate this to a level of art? And it happens. You know, it's just beautiful to see, you know, and to be able to, you know, and at Films, we have different people with these different skill sets
mm-hmm.
that, you know, Donnie Marks and Hank McElwee, or Donnie Marks and Howard Neef are the two kind of legendary cameramen where the people that could get that shot of the full football. Mind you, it's all happening in real speed. I mean, and they're able to shoot a football floating in the air with their looking through a hole the size of a quarter inch, really.
Oh my gosh.
When you, right? I mean, that's more than that. I would say it's a half inch.
But still.
But, you know, you're following something, you're pulling focus while it's happening at real speed. And it's in focus, you're pulling focus, it's full frame. And you pull out right at the right time when the receiver catches the ball. Or, you know, Donnie, he was able to zoom and focus with one hand, like this freakish behavior, and they're opposite motions. You know, if you're zooming one way, you're focusing another way. So he was able with one hand to do that
wow.
with the lens, and that's just nuts. Huh. And you know, there are shots where you'd see where the ball would be full frame, you know, or almost full frame, and then he would zoom in tighter, and you'd think, oh my, you know, like that's just amazing. Or, you know, the shot of the long lens shots to me are the most amazing, because they're in the end zone, for example, and they're looking through a keyhole, mm-hmm. through a really long lens, shooting a guy, catching a kickoff, and that person is running towards their end of the camera guy at full speed, not knowing where they're going to move yet, running up a 100-yard field, and there's centered shot waist up and in focus the whole time as they're running up a field. It'd be like, you know, shooting a gazelle on the Serengeti or something.
Right.
You know, that same skill of following live action that you don't know where it's going to go, but you're able to track it the whole time and keep it centered and in focus. That's insane.
Now,
it is an insane endeavor.
It is. And when you bring up all those technical difficulties or the art form of what it is, I didn't know there was that much art to it as an, or difficulty, the way you're talking about, you know, looking through the camera in such a, just a small view for the person operating it and the touch it takes for that focus, mm-hmm. it sounds like, and the way it's all, yeah, to me, it's brilliant. It really is. It's just,
I got news for
it's
you.
Perfect.
Mm-hmm. Where other people mm-hmm. would go home, mm-hmm. right? The way that we do it, when people would stop shooting,
yeah,
like in crazy snow or a ridiculous downpour or crazy mud, like people would say, you know what, we got to stop shooting.
Yeah.
We're saying this is fabulous,
right?
You know, this is going to be great at 120 frames, and this snow is going to be beautiful. So that's, you know, and that's the production, that's the NFL films, you know, mindset. Is that you make lemonade out of lemons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's something there, the story, and you know, it's pretty amazing to see.
Now
those guys and they live it.
Oh yeah, they must love it. Now, do a lot of people you meet at NFL films, are they fans of the NFL prior to when they worked there, or even yourself? You know, were you a fan of football before you even worked there?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, NFL Films, in a way, is a place, it's a collection of unique people that all have found a way to leverage their love for football and their love for filmmaking. I mean, that's what the building is.
Mm-hmm.
It's really cool that way. It is filled with incredibly talented people. And that's, you know, it's the beautiful thing. I always tell this to people that want to get into the film industry. It's that, you know, it's pumped into your heads that you need to be a director or a director of photography or an executive producer. But you don't need that. There are so many different angles to get into filmmaking, whether you're into doing props, you love sports, you like to write, mm-hmm. or you're into graphics and computers, you know, or you're into math and stats. You know, there's all these different ways to get into the industry that are outside of the realm of being a director or a camera guy. You know, there's obviously audio and music composition, or, you know, scene-to-scene color correction or editing or audio mixing. There's all these different ways that people can partake. And at films or any production endeavor, and I guess, you know, any business for that matter, is so dependent on people in specialized areas doing their job really well with, you know, a certain level of passion and skill and also believing in what they're doing and doing it really well, so that when they hand it off to the next phase to be done, that it's as good as it can be. And that's what films is. Everybody is focused on the task. And whether it is an overall ideology of what we're doing, or whether it's the individual task that we're doing immediately in front of us, we're all on board with that. You know, there's this, at the league, they like to say, you know, it's a responsibility to the team.
Now, because
we all feel that.
Yeah, I mean, and I think those that are watching the end product have no doubt believing that, you know, that there's actually a lot. It definitely looks like it's a passion project. Every single thing that's produced there is. Even those that are a casual football fan, you know, it's something different. I don't think the other sports capture it the same. They just don't have that same element as what NFL Films does. Now, you said you were...
Go ahead. Well, I mean, it's a difference. Yeah. There's a difference between being an innovator and taking the risks, right?
Mm-hmm.
Films was the innovator. They took the risks. They threw the resources behind it early on and made something out of it. And, you know, that's the thing. Steve and Ed took risks.
Yeah.
And it was a passion project. It was all about passion. That's how it started. So that bled through to everybody.
Now, you mentioned that you're an NFL fan, right? And so do you have a moment you can share where maybe you met a player that you were a big fan of, and then you meet them through NFL Films?
You know, I don't. Yeah, you meet a lot of players, and you know what always strikes you. I would say, you know, one of the favorite ones was, you know, Drew Brees. Drew Brees was really cool. And it stands out in my mind, not because of you know, meeting him and being starstruck, but what he did, you know, in order to, we were doing a shoot. This was down, we were filming with Obama in 2009, right after Obama took office, and we were at the White House, and, we filmed on a Tuesday morning. It was a Tuesday. So we were there on Tuesday morning, and Drew played a Monday night football game in New Orleans and showed up Tuesday at the White House.
Wow.
And and I was so blown away by that. And we were doing it was a play 60 spot, you know, encouraging kids to exercise.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, when Michelle Obama and they were doing that, you know, the move,
yep,
PSAs or the move, you know, just to fight obesity and all that. So when Obama saw that, we were there and Obama comes out first and he's, you know, we're talking through some blocking with him. And then in walks, or onto the South Lawn, you know, is Drew Brees. He walks out from the front of the White House, the South Lawn, and Obama just does a double take. He's like, "What are you doing here?" And I thought that both acts spoke volumes. One about, you know, that I thought it was really cool that Obama had the presence of mind to realize that this guy just played last night. And I thought that was pretty cool. And he recognized that and was grateful. And the fact that Brees made that effort and did that, along with a couple other players. And that always struck me as, like, pretty extraordinary to take a beating. You know, your game doesn't end until 11 p.m. or maybe 10:30 where he was. I don't know. Locker room. So, you know, it's a 1 a.m. Yeah. ordeal. And so, you know, he gets on a plane, his day off in the middle of the season, flies to D.C., does this thing. Yeah, I thought that was really cool. And, you know, there's so many people that have been fortunate, you know, football or not, to meet through films. And they've been, by and large, like, really the players, and have been, you know, a great group of people that constantly, for for causes that are important to them. They open up their lives. They spend their time. So it's always cool to see that. And you have fun. Yeah. You know, you get to do different stuff. But that moment really struck me as pretty meaningful. Somebody that was doing something bigger than themselves and made some sacrifice in the middle of their busiest season to show up.
Now, are you currently following pretty closely then to what's going on this season?
Yep.
Okay.
Not terribly, but yes.
Would you happen to have a Super Bowl pick? We're about halfway through the year right now.
I think the Patriots are going to be in it.
Yeah.
And I'd like to see the Saints. I'd like to see Breeze.
That's good. That's good. Those are good picks. And then if that game does happen, New England versus the Saints, who do you like?
It's not a matter of who I like. It's a matter of who I think is going to win.
Who is going to win, right. That's a tough one.
It's hard to say. I think it's the Patriots.
Yeah. It is tough. It is tough to bet against that team, and I think a lot of people would be in agreement New England seems to be on that kind of roll. But I do love the Saints quite a bit. Yeah, I'm a big fan of Drew Brees as well, even though I'm a Steeler fan. I love the Steelers. I like the Packers because where I live, if I don't like the Packers, I would probably get killed. So by my wife.
Yeah.
And
where you are is I spent a lot of time in the Milwaukee area in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
And I guess 96 through the end of the beginning of the end of the Favre era.
Yeah.
We spent a lot of time there. It's a magical place. I love Green Bay and the people in Milwaukee because they did work with Harley Davidson. And so we were out there quite a bit.
Nice. Well, good. I'm glad that they all took care of you well up here in Wisconsin. That's great. That's great to hear.
Sure did.
That's excellent. What other things do you love to do besides working at NFL Films, Alan?
Well, I love to cook. Mm-hmm. Love to travel. Like to paint.
Nice.
Used to and could still play some guitar. It's hard, but I still
into the music.
I should be doing it. All those things I should be doing much more frequently than I do. In terms of the music and the painting and the traveling, but the rest of life gets in the way of that stuff.
Yeah, sometimes it does. But it sounds like the job you have, your current role at NFL Films, is that the director of business development?
Yeah, and that's really kind of cool. It allows me to work with partners and like sponsors and partners of the league to help develop content ideas or to help them as they activate with their affiliation with the league. And then also to bring in new programming. Like for example, this year there's a channel called Epix, E-P-I-X.
Okay.
And they wanted some NFL property on their network. So we're doing a show for them called NFL The Grind. And it's on, actually, it's on right now. They drop it. And it's really a unique show that's kind of this magazine. Well, not a magazine format. It's hosted by Rich Eisen, and he does some cool insight stuff. And then we have some celebrity hosted segments as part of it, where a lot of ex-players, like the first episode this year was Brett Favre, hanging out with Drew Brees. And that was cool because they're down there in that same neck of the woods.
Right.
But it's really a strong show. So that was something that didn't exist a year ago that that I worked with Epics, and, you know, we had to find an opportunity. They wanted something on their network. So worked with somebody at Films. We devised a concept and they liked it, and the show's really cool. So I don't know if people have the Epics channel. I know there's an app, but it's really a cool show. It's a unique half hour insight into the league that's unlike other shows that are on currently.
Nice.
It's pretty neat. The former player celebrity parts are fantastic.
Yeah, it sounds like it's cool to blend those worlds together. Past players, current players, different mm-hmm. celebrities that are fans of the game, kind of see the different worlds colliding like that. I think that's kind of cool. That's a nice idea there, Alan. Good job. I like that.
Well, I just help bring the people together. That's what I like to do. You know, you bring people together, keep ideas alive. Mm-hmm. That's the other thing. Mm-hmm. Keep, you know, never give up. Mm-hmm. Keep deals or ideas. Keep things moving forward, so that the dialogue's going on. And, you know, it could take a while or it could happen rather quickly. Most of the projects I've been involved on that are sizable have taken a really long time to come to fruition. So you need to be patient and also enjoy the process. Enjoy the getting to know people and working through. That's kind of, you know, it's the humanity of all of it. Working with people to achieve a common goal.
Beautifully said. Final question, Alan, before we let you go. If there's someone listening right now, and I'm sure it happens from time to time, or maybe they're checking out the replay on the podcast version of the show, what advice do you give to them? Even though I think there's some of it in there in the last couple sentences you said, but what advice would you give someone that's recently diagnosed and they're listening?
I would say it's all about being prepared, right? I mean, I live in both my personal and professional life, and sometimes I have crude analogies, so you'll have to forgive me, but no matter what it is, like if I was preparing to do a shoot or if I'm preparing for something in life, you have to prepare, and you have to realize, you know, oh shit, you got a diagnosis. Mm-hmm. But then at some point, as soon as you can, you need to move into planning mode. And because you have to take this and make sense out of it. So you don't really have any other choice. So what's happened to you, you now need to recognize it and prepare yourself for different eventualities or scenarios. That's what I did. Right when I got my diagnosis, and maybe it was because you don't want to have too much introspection. I'm a task-oriented person. It's like, okay, I got this. How am I going to deal with this? Okay, well, I need to work towards this goal so that I'm prepared. You know, and that permeates, it goes through every facet of life. Like, okay, I'm living in a house with, you know, two stories or three stories technically, mm-hmm. That are all livable. I need to not be here. Mm-hmm. I need to do things when you need to do things when you have the most choice, not when you're forced to do it. Right. We want that right. dignity.
Right.
We want that feeling that, okay, this is what I choose to do. And the sooner that you take control, the more choices, really thoughtful, well-researched, safe choices you can make to better insulate yourself and your family for the changes that could occur. So And I've seen people not do that, and they wind up being, I hate to use the term, pantsed, but it's like getting your pants pulled down in public. Mm-hmm. I don't allow that to happen. I always prepare, you know, so I don't want to be surprised, and I want to surprise my family, and, you know, I want to be able to live where I want to live, do what I want to do, live a fruitful life, and deal with the changes as they come, and have as much dignity as possible. And the most important thing I would say to somebody that was recently diagnosed too, is that throughout this whole voyage, you know, it's a rather Asian concept, or Eastern philosophy, in terms of, you know, it's really easy to give, but it's very hard to receive help, graciously, that is. So allow people to help you. Don't be stubborn about that. And allow people to help you or ask for help. It takes a lot of pressure off on both an emotional and physical level, right?
Right.
And that's the way that you got to be. You have to accept that I am going to need help from time to time. And I'm either going to make it miserable for myself or miserable and not recognize the graciousness of other people. So you have to back out of yourself and put yourself in a mindset of graciously receiving the help. And that changes everything.
Good advice. Good advice. I like all of it. Well done, sir. Well, thank you, Alan, for...
that's what you got to do.
Absolutely. You got to roll with it. You got to be prepared. And we appreciate you being on here and sharing your story. And I know you're coming back, I think, on the show for a quick bit when we do the big December 3rd telethon. I think I got your name on the list there, so I'm excited that you're going to be a part of that with us. So we look forward to talking to you again.
Oh, cool. Yep.
All right, take care,
cool,
Alan.
Cool, I think that one's in the morning. So
yeah, it is.
Thank you. Take care.
All right, bye-bye. So that's Alan Brown, NFL Films. He is currently the director of business development for NFL Films. I could have talked to him about possible, you know, other NFL stories, and oh my goodness. I mean, just tapping into that world, I went kind of fan gaga on that one. But great interview with him because he brought in such great, raw, good stories, great advice at the end. I think being prepared is very important. Make the decision yours. Own the decision, as in, like, don't let this take you over where you're not making a decision. The disease is doing it for you, in a way. It's kind of how I paraphrase that. And I think that's good or great advice. I wanted to also talk a little bit about what I did tease there in the beginning of the show, and there also with Alan. We have December 3rd, mark it on your calendars. We do have another two podcast episodes coming up, but a separate side show is coming up on December 3rd. It's going to be the Giving Tuesday telethon event. I'm going to be on air, Facebook Live, in four large segments, starting at 7 a.m. all the way to 11 p.m., I believe that's Central Time. Yep, Central Time. So we have guests like Alan Brown that was just on, Chris Carino, who is the announcer of the Brooklyn Nets, Dave Lucas, Beth Johnston, Scott Harper, so many more. Amy Becker, who I see is joined in on this show today, Taylor Quigg, George Pollock, Curtis, and Allison Calder. That's just to name a few. The list goes on and on that are filling up our guest list, and they will be on 20-minute segments. Quick interviews talking about FSHD Society, maybe their FSHD story, and we're just going to roll one after the other, and we'll be on pretty much all day, except a couple little breaks in the action. So I'm looking forward to that. We have awesome guests coming up for the next couple shows. For one, it is, let's see, November 20th. So we got a couple changes coming up on November and December shows because it's right around the holidays. We still want you here. I don't want to take you away from your family life out there visiting with your families or them visiting with you at your homes. So on November 20th, we're going to have Jenny Hassenjager and Levi Benson on, singer and songwriters. They're going to bring in their FSHD story. So I'm looking forward to talking with them in December. And I believe that's the 18th, if I check it real quick here.
Yep. Wednesday, December 18th, we're going to have Meredith Hummel on from the North Carolina chapter. She's got a lot of good things to share with us in December, and then we just keep rolling. So a lot of big things coming up. It's been my pleasure bringing the show to you today. Before I let you go, I want to also quickly remind those out there of a couple things coming up just over this weekend here, like November 2nd, the Utah chapter meeting. That's 10 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. in Salt Lake City, Utah. Southwest Florida chapter launch meeting, that's huge, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Hoffman Home in Naples, Florida. Austin support group meeting, that sounds like a new group coming together on November 2nd, 3 to 4 p.m., Austin, Texas. The 4th, the Connecticut Connections, they have a special guest speaker from 7 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. Looks like they're welcoming David Younger, who is a guest actually on this podcast not long ago. So that'll be interesting for them. And the list of events goes on, including like a chapter meeting happening in Chicago, their last of the year on November 9th. That's exciting if you're in the area, want to get there. November 9th also has the North Carolina chapter meeting, as the aforementioned Meredith runs that chapter. Colorado chapter meeting as well on November 9th. That's an event hall, 1 p.m. to 1:30 p.m. in the Colorado area. So you want to know more details about meeting groups happening in your area with chapter things going on and all the things going on, visit fshdsociety.org. Check it all out. If you want to know more about this podcast, you can email me if you'd like or ask me questions. Feel free to fshradiohost@gmail.com is my direct email line. You can do that. Welcome to take your questions or maybe questions for upcoming guests. If you want to shoot them my way, that'd be awesome. Let's see. I hope I'm not missing anything else. I think that's going to wrap it up for today. I appreciate y'all for joining me. Check out, the podcasts are also everywhere you can find podcasts, on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, you name it, Podcast Addict. Find those apps on your device. Search FSHD Society Radio Show or FSH Society Radio Show. You should find us and listen to past episodes. Share with your friends. We'd appreciate it, and rate the show. Take care. We will see you next month, November 20th. Be here. This has been the FSHD Society Radio Show.